From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. On April 20th, something happened that we hardly ever see in the United States.
Breaking news. We've just learned the jury has reached a verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, charged in the death of George Floyd.
A police officer was found guilty in the death of an American citizen.
Derek Chauvin, guilty on all three counts. The former Minneapolis police officer, now a convicted murderer.
He now faces what could be a maximum of 40 years in prison.
Despite the overwhelming evidence against Derek Chauvin, including the infamous video of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, the verdict was not a foregone conclusion. On this episode, we're going to look at why that is with Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve. She's an associate professor of sociology at Brown, and she spent 10 years working in and studying the criminal court system of Cook County, home to Chicago. Her 2016 book, Crook County, offers as good an answer as you're likely to find for why police officers are so rarely charged in cases of police violence. It's an enlightening book, and we get into all the overlapping forces that protect police who commit crimes, including the surprising role prosecutors play in keeping this system from changing. We started, though, by talking about the readout of Derek Chauvin's charges on April 20th. Here's Nicole.
And in a very emotional moment on April 20th, we heard the guilty verdict on all three charges. And what was amazing is there was almost like a hush that went over the entire world. I felt like for the 10 seconds prior to the jury verdict, you heard the judge make an announcement. The camera zoomed in on Chauvin's face. All you could see was just kind of his eyes going back and forth with the mask over his face. And then they went on every charge, guilty, guilty, guilty. And the judge had every juror say what their finding was. And just to hear the percussive guilty from all 12 juries was a really emotional and searing moment for so many people who've either protested or been following this case.
So I want to talk about the significance of this case in the context of the criminal justice system in America. You know, you've written this amazing book called Crook County, Racism and Injustice in America's Largest Criminal Court. And I think it's really important for people, just ordinary people, to understand why it is so difficult to charge police officers with crimes or, for example, excessive use of force. What is so hard about that? What is the relationship that we don't understand?
Right. Well, you know, there's so many institutions and laws that protect officers from any type of accountability, even in cases of murder. And I think, you know, I accidentally walked into this research topic, and I know that that's a very strange statement to make. Usually researchers go very intentionally with a hypothesis, but I was studying the court system, and I did that for over a decade in the Chicago criminal courts. For over a decade, I was either embedded or doing multiple types of data collection within the nation's largest unified court system in America. And it was there, embedded in the prosecutor's office, that I got to see how prosecutors in some ways deferred blindly to police officers, even when suspects were found dead and the officers' stories didn't make sense. And so that was kind of my first entry point into this system that was so far from what we're promised in the letter of the law. And in 2015, before my book came out, you know, this enormous amount of data collection that stretched from when I was an undergrad through getting my PhD through being a young assistant professor, there was a case, the Laquan McDonald case, where a young man was shot 16 times. And there was this mobilization by the police force to just cover it up. Intimidate witnesses at the scene. They've arrested a father and a son for basically saying that this teenager was, murdered on the street. And so they, in good faith, were interviewing with the police, and the police retaliated against them and arrested them and put them in the Cook County jail. You had police officers tampering with the video evidence from a neighboring Burger King, with the owners thinking that the police were, you know, trying to investigate a murder. And nothing could be farther from the truth. They were engaging in a type of clandestine cover-up that's part of what we've called the code of silence, which is officers protect officers at all costs. And I think what most people don't realize is that code of silence and violence extends all the way into the court system. So there's this whole practice and protocol with prosecutors that when they see these cases that are shaded or, you know, where the officer is overtly lying.
Testa-lying, you've said.
Yes, testa-lying. They even have a word for it. They, in some ways, engage in that cover-up. You know, prosecutors describe putting up blinders on to not question officers. And their description of what it meant to question officers was just downright scary and chilling. One officer in the sample, you know, he described that he tried to whistleblow and he went up all the chain of command. You know, in the first chain of command, they said, what are you, a defense attorney? Why would you do this? The second chain of command, a supervisor threw an ashtray at him, even, you know, threatening him and actually acting on some physical violence. And ultimately, he was marginalized in the office and was never allowed to see the chief prosecutor. So these practices have gone on for generations. And one of the frustrations I've had as a researcher is trying to help the public as well as other researchers understand that these dynamics are generalizable. There's not something particularly wrong with Chicago, but it's ordinary in its dysfunction. And so when we fast forward to George Floyd and his death, the first thing that they did, the officers did, was say it was a medical accident. You know, they started this kind of shadow legal system where covering up and creating these narratives that protect themselves allow this type of murder, this unchecked level of violence, to continue. And as we know, the prosecutor in this case, the local one, was unwilling to charge Chauvin with murder. So again, we see the same patterns across jurisdiction.
I wonder if you could be really explicit about what a prosecutor's job is. Why are they sort of beholden to the police? Why? What is in that relationship that is interdependent in a way?
Well, the letter of the law and even the Supreme Court and even the American Bar Association's Code of Ethics say that prosecutors should pursue justice. It's supposed to be thoughtful. It's supposed to be evidence driven. And the Supreme Court is very explicit about that, as well as the ethical standards within the profession. But yet we have a system that falls woefully short of those expectations. And one of the issues is that there's this kind of perverse incentive structure with built-in prosecutions offices across the nation, which is the only way to get promoted is to, quote unquote, win cases and win them at all costs. And that is their definition of justice. It's an organizational definition of justice. It's a marker of who's the best litigator. And so the problem becomes if a young prosecutor sees a case that doesn't make sense, the evidence is weak, or if it's a first-time offender and the prosecutor says, I don't want to ruin this young person's life. They're in possession of drugs. They're clearly addicted. I will choose not to charge. That is all within their discretion. The problem is that type of prosecutor will never get promoted within the organization. So as people always ask, well, where are the good prosecutors? Where are the good police officers? They are at a very junior level, kind of pushed out of these organizations. So they never rise to a leadership position. So without changing those incentive structures, prosecutors are still not rewarded for, you know, questioning an officer. And I think that is at the heart of why we've seen so many murders, and we've all been so disappointed that the criminal justice system and its courts have been unable to right these wrongs.
The one thing we aren't talking about yet that you describe in your book is the racialized aspect of this mistreatment. First of all, why is it important to understand that justice is not colorblind? And how does systemic racism sort of perpetuate this alliance between officers and prosecutors?
Well, you know, when I started this study, I was not a race scholar. I was not a scholar that even understood theorizing race and racism. And I fully admit that because I think it's an important lesson to all of us is that if you're a law scholar, a policy scholar, a criminal justice scholar, you tend to study the criminal justice system like it's a machine, right? Like there's bureaucracy and culture and organizational practices. And we are instructed to kind of assume that the system is race neutral. But walking into the criminal justice system and you see in a court that the whole place is segregated. And there's mostly a divide between who is prosecuting cases, which basically an all-white cast of lawyers and judges and police officers, and basically a marginalized class of defendants who are mostly Black, Latino, and from the poorest neighborhoods in the city of Chicago. From the moment I walked in, I could almost feel the racial demarcation of these places. And to then ignore it felt like it was an irresponsible thing to do as a social scientist. In fact, I kept saying, how is everybody ignoring this? Like, I see it so clearly. And so my task was thinking, this place is completely demarcated, structurally, spatially. They used slurs like the word mope, which was basically the N-word, kind of recoded in a more colorblind term. And that demarcated a type of defendant. So a defendant with charged with a lesser charge. So someone like George Floyd, if he would have lived, he would have been prosecuted like a quote unquote mope. In the prosecutor's worldview, someone who is a mope is not worthy of a trial. So George Floyd, if he would have lived, would have been charged with a low grade crime. He would have been sent to jail to await trial. He wouldn't have made bail. He certainly would have been forced to plead guilty. And that assumption then led to this huge, you know, percentage of cases, almost 95% of the cases being pled guilty. But at the core of those charges were racial meanings. You couldn't talk about possession of drugs without talking about the racial association. Because we know that white people, especially upper class white people, are in possession of lots of drugs. I worked in an ad agency, and after 9/11, they shut down the entire floor because they found white powder in the bathroom, and people at the time thought it was anthrax. And of course, the Chicago police came in, and no, it was powdered cocaine. And yet, in those courts, it's so racialized that it is pretty much the only people targeted with possession, for instance, are Black people. And so the slurs become normalized. They rationalize the slurs as being non-racial. For violent offenders, they're referred to as monsters, and that has a whole other racialized connotation, which I don't focus on as much, but that is part of the racialized nature of these two extremes. You're either the mope or the monster. But one of my arguments in Crook County is that this is an important feature of the criminal court system. It helps these attorneys sort through a huge case volume in a really quick and efficient way. And so I think that that is the most painful part of this, is that, you know, the argument is that sometimes these quote unquote, you know, racist handles, these racial tropes allow for the type of efficient justice that allows mass incarceration to sustain itself. And I think that's a really troubling finding. But I think it also points to how someone could kneel on George Floyd and kill him so easily. I think at the heart of those racialized meanings allows for such deep dehumanization that you don't see defendants of color as anything like you. You can't even see them as being victimized. You can't even see them as dying. When people ask, well, how could this happen? How could they do this, right? How did he not see, when people were begging Chauvin, you know, please stop, you're killing him, how could Chauvin not see that he was victimizing someone? Well, these racial conceptions are so powerful that they do reproduce a type of violence that allows for things that we can never imagine. And I think that's the true kind of horror in all of it.
You know, I worry a lot about the psychic toll that this kind of, what you have laid out so well, the toll that that must take on an African-American police officer or an African-American prosecutor. The decisions that they have to make must be incredibly brain-breaking.
Right. Well, my friend Paul Butler, he's a professor at Georgetown Law, and I think he wrote best on this topic. He was a federal prosecutor for years, and, you know, he was from Chicago, from the areas, you know, around the court system that I study. And, you know, he went to Yale, he went to Harvard. And so him being a prosecutor was a really badge of great honor. And I think, you know, in his neighborhood, he thought, well, I'm superior. I have this great education. And he was prosecuting the types of kids that might have, you know, roughed him up for quote unquote talking white or acting white. And, you know, he talks about the struggle between that. He had rationalized the decision to be a prosecutor by saying he would be quote unquote an undercover brother. So he'd be, you know, in there changing the system from within, right? He would do this. And, what ends up happening to Paul, Professor Butler ends up getting arrested outside his own home and arrested on a charge where a random neighbor complains about him and the police don't believe his story. And he says, listen, I'm a prosecutor to the police. I'm a prosecutor. This is what happened. Hold tight. I understand how the system works. And he's pleading with them and they arrest him. And his buddies in the prosecution's office, guess what they do? They treat him like the mopes. And that prosecutor label does not save him. He actually has to go to trial on the charge, hire an attorney to support him because the stakes were so high that if he was convicted, he would, you know, his career would be over as he'd be in jail with the same people that he actually convicted. He ends up, of course, exonerated, right? He's found not guilty. But I think, you know, his story was to me the most compelling reason that really shows that these racial labels are so powerful that even if you are a black prosecutor, you will always be a black prosecutor. And to be a prosecutor means that that black person or Latinx person has to contribute to enormous amounts of abuse in the system. So when I was in Chicago, Anita Alvarez, another Latina from the little village area around the jail, she was the chief prosecutor and she was the attorney or the prosecutor that would not charge the officers in the death of Laquan McDonald. And so, you know, I always remind people, if you are a person of color in these offices, you can comply. You know, there were people of color on the scene. There was officers that were minoritized officers with Chauvin. During the death of Eric Gardner, you see minoritized officers that are walking around Eric Gardner's dead body and not calling for help in a panicked way. You can participate in enormous amounts of violence within these institutions. So it is both, I think, psychologically very hard, which I think Professor Butler's account talks about, is that you're constantly proving yourself and you're constantly rationalizing, am I doing the right thing? Am I the actual undercover brother or am I an instrument for incarceration and abuse? And I think it's a really tough dilemma because on the one hand, you know, we always say, well, diversity will matter. But on the other hand, the system is designed with such amounts of violence and unaccountability that it is hard to be a disruptor when you're just one person or you're just a few people. You're expected to comply.
And vulnerable.
And you're extremely vulnerable. So the whistleblowers in many of these cases, like the white prosecutor had the ashtray thrown at his head. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, police will harass other officers that break the code of silence. And the threat of physical violence is always looming. It's always part of what makes people comply.
You know, this was a particular case. There was a video. There were bystanders. There was death. So I wonder about going forward, can we see this, the results of this case, the fact that the police chief testified against Chauvin, can we see this as progress? Is this a flashpoint or is this going to be held up as a sort of an exception? What do you think?
So I think this was like a very big flashpoint case. And so I kind of take this case as the anomaly. In some way, it was ordinary, meaning the police wanted us to ignore this the way they want us to ignore all cases. And we saw that in the mobilization of the lie from the moment that George Floyd was killed, that it was a medical incident rather than an act of murder. So in that respect, the case was kind of normal. There is always a narrative that comes after the misconduct. And the narrative also always is in favor of the police doing the reasonable thing. I think we heard that a lot in the trial. What would a reasonable officer do? And the police will make it sound reasonable. I think what is different is that this case, I keep saying, was not supposed to happen, meaning this case was never supposed to see a courtroom. And if it was up to the local prosecutor, it never would have. And if it was up to the police themselves, it never should have gone. And I think what did it was the mobilization of people. And that is something that I had not seen before in my career because I've worked on so many cases. So I've, you know, since 2015, I was writing my book and Michael Brown, Tamir Rice and Eric Gardner all died around the same time. I called them the Holy Trinity at the time because each one broke my heart in a different way. Like a young man that had his whole future ahead of him. Eric Gardner, a father, and then Tamir Rice, a child. And it was like at every stage of their lives, black men were not safe. And yet, you know, on Facebook and social media, mostly, you know, white friends in suburban areas that I'm you know, linked to on Facebook were having Thanksgiving like nothing was happening. And so I think, you know, what was truly inspiring to me was that something about George Floyd's death at this time made people march in the streets and notice in a different way. And that seemed transformative because as they were seating the jury, it was hard for the defense to find these absolute law and order people that whole cloth believe that police narratives are just fine, right? It was almost like even the more conservative jurors were kind of starting to question the judgment of officers. And I think that is transformative, which is if we would have more jurors sit on a jury and just start to question whether an officer could lie. That is a transformative concept for many people. I do think that this case has been a flashpoint. So it is the charging of this officer is rare. The conviction is rare. You know, I think all of it's rare. I think what I will caution people is that this is a beginning and not an end, which is I think that, you know, if white Americans feel that their eyes are open, they should stay open and say, this is a symbol, but it is not the substance. And the substance comes with reform that would change the incentive structures and all the institutions that protect officers. There's been no reform since George Floyd's murder. Not one thing has been done to prevent his murder, which is why, as you cited, there have been since the trial began, there have been about 3 deaths every single day. And that's astounding.
You touched on educated jurors earlier, Nicole, and I love this idea of finding a way to educate jurors so that they are not going in with these assumptions that the police officer would never lie on the stand. And I think the key to that is enlightening them about the relationship between the police and prosecutors and what is motivating them and how they're codependent.
Yeah, I think one of the things that sometimes astounds people who are not in academia is that, you know, academics are good at doing the research, but they often stop short of disseminating the research, like actually getting it into the hearts and minds of everyday people so that it can change. And I remember when I was getting my PhD, one of my advisors said, you know, she was kind of having a bad day. And she said, you know, what does all of this matter? It doesn't change anything. And as a gender scholar, I said, well, you know, a long time ago, they used to ask, you know, sexual assault victims, what were you wearing? And that was an important part of a legal case. And it took both the research and the activism, right, to stop that it didn't matter, that sexual assault was a crime of violence, not a crime of sexuality, right? That all happened very slowly, too slowly, but it happened. And it was the work of both academics and activists kind of in partnership. And one of the things that I've really thought long and hard about is, you know, whose side are we on? And I think in our pursuit of being objective in research, we cannot lose sight of the larger principles of humanity and dignity and ethics and human rights. It's okay to ask those kinds of questions. And so one of the commitments that I have is once the findings were collected in my book, I made a commitment to spend 1 year. I left it 1 year. I said 1 year to educate the public. And that meant op-ed writings, commentary pieces, doing podcasts, Rachel Maddow show, CNN, you know, and I'm going to tell you, my point is always the same, right? The prosecutors are enabling the misconduct. They're right. So, everything that we talked about today, I am hitting those communication points over and over and over again, because I think over time it does start to change. And the jury that we saw here in 2021 is different from a jury that we might have seen in 2016. And it sure does break my heart that so many people are continuing to die. And it makes me enraged. But one thing that I'm left with is a sense of optimism about the Floyd case, which is you had people believe, especially white people who don't experience the same type of policing as Black people and Latinx people. You had a wide multiracial coalition of people that finally started to see who the real victim was in this case, and that a police officer can be a criminal, can be a perpetrator. And that is a pattern, a cultural script that we've all seen now. And my hope is that the activism continues to be in line with what we've seen. And I think that takes a lot of work.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much for the amazing work you do, and I hope you'll come back on Trending Globally again.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by Dan Richards and Alina Coleman. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Sarah Baldwin. If you like us, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you have a friend who you think would like the show, tell them about it. We'll be back next week with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks.